Kennedy is an avid whitewater rafter, has a long-standing interest in environmental issues related to water resources, water pollution, and the Hudson River. So anyway, you read this, and what you find out is you've got a Democrat here who's an attorney, who is actually an environmentalist, who's very concerned about water quality. Now, vaccines probably aren't necessarily in his wheelhouse, but as somebody who's interested in water quality and environmentalism, well, what you're finding here is somebody that is traditionally, and a Democrat, and a Kennedy, is somebody who's traditionally on the left, who's coming out against the vaccine. Ooh, now that's a little more nuanced story about somebody being an anti-vaxxer. Wikipedia can't have it.
Right.
This guy is not Alex Jones.
But the label that he's given earlier on, anti-vaccine activist and a conspiracy theorist, it'd be hard to distinguish him from Alex Jones. So from there, we move on to this. Is Robert F. Kennedy the best unbiased source on information about a vaccine? I'd argue no. And that's good enough to know we should probably just move on, Caulfield said. He probed deeper into the method to find better coverage by copying the main claim in Mr. Kennedy's post and pasting it into a Google search. The first two results came from, I'm guessing this is like some French press agency's fact check website, and the National Institutes of Health. His quick searches showed a pattern. So this is where I was like, is this guy fucking with us? The first two results show a pattern. Mr. Kennedy's claims were... All right, now here we go. Now here we go. Mr. Kennedy's claims were outside the consensus, a sign they were motivated by something other than science.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Some people have had changes in behavior, hostility, agitation, depressed mood, and suicidal thoughts or actions.
Call your doctor if you have high fever, stiff muscles, and confusion to address a possible life-threatening condition, or if you have uncontrollable muscle movements, as these could become permanent.
Women of childbearing age should have a negative pregnancy test and practice effective birth control due to the potential risk to the fetus.
Walking, eating, driving, or engaging in other activities while asleep, without remembering it the next day, have been reported.
Do not take Belvique if you're pregnant, planning to be, or nursing.
You may have heard about the private school telling its teachers not to get the vaccine, citing debunked claims about its impact on fertility. The school's co-founder falsely suggesting that vaccinated people may be transmitting something from their bodies and shouldn't be near students until more information is known. A teacher at the school even told a 10-year-old student, "Don't hug your vaccinated parents for more than 5 seconds." That teacher and the school's founder later apologized for the remarks, but, you know, a card laid. So where's the misinformation coming from, and what's being done to stop it? Here's CNBC's Meg Terrell.
This is going to be, I think, one of our really daunting problems.
For Dr. Peter Hotez, combating vaccine misinformation has become almost a full-time job.
We have to make this work.
Alongside his work developing a coronavirus vaccine.
It's equally important now to do something in parallel, which is to combat this massive onslaught of anti-vaccine, anti-science disinformation.
He says it's exploded during the course of the pandemic. The Center for Countering Digital Hate, a nonprofit that tracks misinformation online, says followers across platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram of 425 anti-vaccine accounts rose by 877,000 from June to December to more than 59 million. They say two-thirds of the content is attributable to just 12 people, who they call the Disinformation Dozen. Among them, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who the Washington Post reports was invited in January to speak at Miami's Sentner Academy. Calls are rising for social media companies to remove access for these users, arguing they violate terms of service agreements by spreading misinformation. Kennedy Jr. said in a statement the Center for Countering Digital Hate, quote, has not been able to identify any example of vaccine misinformation that he's shared. Now Hotez is calling for even more action from the highest levels of the government against these groups and Russia.
Meg, the CDC is reporting today that some reactions to the J&J shot were actually anxiety-related.
Call your doctor if you have confusion, sweating, fever, or stiff muscles.
May increase suicidal thoughts or actions in some children, teens, and young adults in the first few months.
Don't stop taking Eliquis unless your doctor tells you to, as stopping increases your risk of having a stroke.
Ruptured spleen, sometimes fatal, as well as serious lung problems and allergic reactions have occurred.
Stop use and call your doctor if you have an allergic reaction, as this can be serious.
And redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. As a new wave of the coronavirus emerges, health officials in Louisiana are facing a formidable challenge, fighting for influence as they face deep mistrust.
Risk of suicide may occur.
That has been stoked by conservative news outlets and lawmakers and by rampant misinformation online. The New York Times reports this morning that nowhere is the struggle as urgent as the northwest corner of Louisiana, where the immediate crisis is confounding and demoralizing health officials. We know the results of misinformation, but what about the origins of it? The New York Times recently looked into one man who many say is the most influential spreader. Osteopathic physician Joseph Mikola has become the chief spreader of coronavirus misinformation online, the Times reports. His audience is substantial.
What does this doctor have to benefit from spreading lies that he obviously knows will not only get people sick, but will kill them?
Well, you know, Joseph Mikola is someone who started off in natural medicine very early in the 1990s, and he launched one of the first websites that sold natural health products. What we've seen is that over the last 20 years, he's profited hugely off that website. In the last year alone, he's pivoted towards selling supplements, vitamin supplements, that he says will cure and treat vitamin D. Vitamin D will cure and treat COVID-19. And we've seen the FDA cite him about those claims. They told him that he cannot tell people that the types of vitamins and supplements he sells on his website, really at great profit, will help people with COVID-19.
And Ramesh, it tells you exactly how desperate the situation is when you actually have a doctor that is one of the largest purveyors of these lies about COVID that is killing thousands of people.
Yeah, without question, Joe. We have to interrogate and understand the engines by which misinformation and disinformation spread.
Confusion, agitation, and hallucinations may occur.
And may be fatal.
And call your doctor right away if you experience a sudden decrease in vision or hearing.
Serious side effects are mood changes like depression and mania.
Friends, this is Brett. Today is Thursday, July 29th, 2021. And this is the part two in my conversation with Scott Hambrick on the New York Times op-ed finger quotes. Don't go down the rabbit hole. Remember the subtitle there. Critical thinking, as we're taught to do it, isn't helping in the fight against misinformation. You can learn more about Scott at scotthambrick.com. He also has an occasional podcast called Scott Stream. You can subscribe to that on any podcatcher. I highly recommend the Online Great Books podcast. I am the producer of that show. The one coming out today is called Socratic Scribbling. It's part one of two in a conversation about a method towards being a better thinker and communicator. Very practical and timely show. But we pick up where we left off. I wound the conversation back about a minute and a half, and we're examining this supposed methodology for not falling victim to misinformation. We will later on in this discussion get into the disinformation Dirty Dozen previewed in the intro to the show. And what can I say? I'm really happy with this. I'm really happy that we took this opportunity to kind of go down a rabbit hole. And then through this conversation, Scott provides, I think, a lot of both timely and timeless wisdom when it comes to the practice of critical thinking. That's what I like to think we specialize in here at the School Sucks Project. I do need to tell you, I have a very, very important announcement. Nathan Fraser and I had a real heart-to-heart the other day about our upcoming Mindset and Mastery Summit, and we have changed several things. This is a kind of a big development for us. Number one, the price is different. Please go to mindsetandmastery.com and just take a look at what's happened there, because we want this thing full. We can take up to 100 people. We didn't get that many last time. And we want a full house for a more refined product. Some of those seats have already been taken by the people who enrolled in the first summit because they can come back for free. We have also changed the dates. We realize that the last weekend of what is the summer for many people is not ideal. So we have moved it 2 weeks into the future. It is now September 11th and September 12th, 2021. So please come join us for a very controlled demolition of your self-limiting beliefs. Mindsetandmastery.com. We hope to see you there. We'll get right back into this conversation. We're talking about the SIFT method. which, according to the New York Times and this academic, let's say you find yourself off the reservation and kind of thinking for yourself, number one, stop. I mean, fucking stop. And now that you've like paused and regained control, investigate the source. So according to this article, you can get all the help you need from places like Google and Wikipedia. For example, we can go to Brett Weinstein. That's a name that's come up on the show a lot. And if I'm looking for help, I see there is a section here called COVID-19. And there's a subheading, Further Information, COVID-19 Misinformation. That's a link that you can click, so we'll click it. And remember, what we're doing here is investigating the source. So from Wikipedia, we learn there's some COVID-19 misinformation, but Wikipedia also provides a COVID-19 misinformation page, which takes us on to number three, find better coverage. And here there are infographics from UNESCO. Oh, this page is a hoot. Let's see, virus origin hypothesis, 2.6, Jewish origin in the United States. An alert by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation regarding the possible threat of far-right extremists intentionally spreading coronavirus disease. 2019 mentioned blame being assigned to Jews and Jewish leaders for causing the pandemic and several statewide shutdowns. Source number 134. ABC News, white supremacists encouraging their members to spread coronavirus to cops and Jews. I have to, oh man, don't go down rabbit holes. All right, now we're on ABC News. White supremacists encourage their members to spread coronavirus to cops, Jews, FBI says. An alert was sent out to local police agencies by federal officials. This is March 23rd, 2020. Quick skim of this article reveals no substantiation or links. It appears to be a solitary report written during the highly speculative chaos of March 2020. So no links, no substantiation, very few quotes, very few similar reports. But we learn here that none of that means it's not good enough to be entered into the record in Wikipedia's fight against misinformation. So what am I doing right now? Yeah, I was testing out the SIFT method against Brett Weinstein. So if you're here at step three and not just hopelessly plagued by curiosity like I am, thus your recommended 30-second allotment of independent research time hasn't expired yet, you can go on to step four, T, which is to trace claims, quotes, and media to the original context. But for the average reader of that article, doesn't that suddenly seem like not a very good use of time? Considering at the previous steps, it has been learned that the man in question is one Kevin Bacon unit away from a white supremacist bioterrorism plot? Thanks for listening. Here we go.
Come all you pretty women with your hair hanging down. Open up your windows, 'cause the candy man's in town. Come on, boys, and gamble. Roll those laughing bowls. 7 come 11, boys, I'll take your money home. Look out, the candy man. Here he comes and he's gone again. Pretty lady ain't got no friend till the candy man comes round again.
Yeah, so we're getting to this practical lesson here where in 2016, Mr. Caulfield met Mr. Weinberg, who suggested modeling the process after the way professional fact-checkers assess information. Mr. Caulfield refined the practice into four simple principles. Number one, stop. That's with whatever harmful information you're engaging with accidentally. Two, investigate the source. Three, find better coverage. And four, trace claims, quotes, and media to the original context, otherwise known as SIFT. Stop, investigate, find better coverage, trace claims. All right, don't get too angry yet, because this next paragraph is good. Mr. Caulfield walked me through the process of using an Instagram post from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a prominent anti-vaccine activist, there's a label, falsely alleging a link between the human papilloma virus vaccine and cancer. Quote, "If this is not a claim where I have a depth of understanding, then I want to stop for a second and, before going further, just investigate the source," Mr. Caulfield said. He copied Mr. Kennedy's name in the Instagram post and popped it into Google. Quote, "Look how fast this is," he told me as he counted the seconds out loud. In 15 seconds, he navigated to Wikipedia and scrolled through the introductory section of the page, highlighting with his cursor the last sentence, which reads that Mr. Kennedy is an anti-vaccine activist and a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
So there you go. Two ad hominem labels swallowed, and you're ready to move on. No further questions.
Earlier in the show, you mentioned Zero Hedge, and I've read this article, so I know that he's going to tell you that to go to Wikipedia to verify truth claims.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you did that, I don't know, 14 minutes ago or whatever it was, I went to Wikipedia on the homepage of Wikipedia, and I typed in Zero Hedge. Before I hit enter for to do the search, it pops up possible matches, and there's actually one possible match here that pops up, Zero Hedge. The slug under it says far-right libertarian financial blog. Then I go ahead and hit enter and then get the page. It doesn't say far-right libertarian blog anywhere on the page. So if you just type it in, you get that line. Oh, okay, well, I know all about this source. You don't even have to go to the page.
Oh, my God, you don't have to go to pages anymore.
Right.
You don't even have to go to the pages you're told to go to anymore.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same thing with the slug that Google puts in, right? Like if you search something in Google... Which, I mean, this was a problem like kids were doing. This was even before I think I was done tutoring. So we're going back 6 or 7 years. Kids are just entering things into Google. And then whatever appears in the upper fold of Google results is, again, back to the Wall Street Journal thing on Google from 2019. That situation hasn't improved with what Google is doing.
At the core of this, though, and as we go on, we're going to see more of this. This is basically progressive scientism. Right. Where somebody makes a truth claim, and the way we validate that, the way we prove a truth claim is through consensus. Scientific research is now like that. You and I do a study, it gets peer reviewed, and it becomes, and there's a scientific consensus, and now that's true.
Right.
Full stop. That's how they do it. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You know, we had that billions of dollars worth of fish oil were sold to help people with heart disease. And then that's discredited and quote unquote debunked. And now doctors who are up on quote the literature don't recommend that people with high cholesterol and heart problems take fish oil anymore. But that was the gospel for 30 years, probably. But social sciences have adopted that sort of methodology. And now it's crept into the New York Times opinion section here. Just because everybody thinks it's true doesn't mean it's true. Like there's a capital T truth that exists and is available that people have access to through their rationality. That's what I believe. You don't access that truth by taking a poll. And essentially Wikipedia, it's a database of knowledge that is compiled by consensus.
Right.
You know, people go in there and they can edit it and contribute to the thing, and it's a mess. I highly recommend Infogalactic for your wiki knowledge searching. But this is what people think. This is what they think now.
So this is actually kind of what I gleaned from just the preliminary research I did into our original topic, the Delphi method. The original method, before it was applied to the so-called wisdom of crowds, right, or the right. Synthetic wisdom of crowds, was to convene a group of experts on a question and then run the experts through a series of rounds until these experts achieved a kind of consensus. So once you have that expert consensus, you just manipulate the public into feeling like it's their consensus, when the original consensus could have all kinds of it's like in the whole follow the science thing, and then pharmaceutical companies and their new technologies, or even non-pharmaceutical companies like Moderna and their new experimental technologies becoming synonymous with science, and science becoming synonymous with like God. I mean, that's basically what we've seen, right? This is the word of God is all consensus based. That was a very clever path that I think we've seen followed, like in the scientism thing over the last 20 years, where something that, again, if you just want to make it left and right, something that was a property of the left was kind of iconoclasm, counterculturalism. And now we see this transformation that's like the edgy views of the resistance brought to you by Amazon.com and Wells Fargo Bank.
Yeah.
That's an accomplishment.
Well, a few words about the Delphi process.
Sure.
I think people should look into that. It's very interesting. And once you've seen it as its evil permutation, you'll see it a lot. You'll see it in meetings, in corporate meetings. You'll see it in town hall meetings. You're going to see it a lot once you understand the perversion of it. But it was, I believe that it was invented by the Rand Corporation.
Yes.
For all of you tragedy and hopers. Rand Corporation. And I think their original experiment was like this. They drew in a number of experts, like a mathematician, an economist, and an electrical engineer. I can't remember. A varied group of subject matter experts into a room. And they said, assume that there is a nuclear attack or an atomic weapons attack on the United States. How many weapons do you think that it would take to disable the infrastructure of the United States? It was a question something like that. And all of these experts then weigh, they answer all the questions and they weigh in, and there is a range of answers, right? Oh, we need 52 cities attacked. Once maybe somebody says 3 cities attacked. Somebody says they need 600 kilotons. Somebody else says something else, megatons, whatever, right? But there's a range of responses to this question, which is a prediction, right? It's they're not actually trying to validate a truth claim here. They're trying to make a prediction and trying to make some educated guesses. They bring educated people in the room, have them guess. And then they come back based on the results they've already got with a new round of questions. And they're trying to get the findings from this survey of these experts to converge on a narrow set of results. Now, because the Strategic Air Command and the Civil Defense Force is trying to figure out what to do if there's a nuclear attack, and they can't just look at these huge ranges of opinions about what could happen. They have to figure out what's likely to happen. And they assume that whoever attacks them will use a panel of experts to figure out what kind of attack to place. So they're assuming that their experts are similar to the experts that will be planning the attack, blah, blah, blah. Seems like a good approach to me. Mm-hmm. That seems like a good approach to me to try to figure out, oh, a power grid failure next winter is a possibility. It failed in Texas last year. It might be good to bring in some experts about manufacturing and power transmission and so on, oil and gas people, and try to figure out what they think the power failures in the future could look like and how devastating they may or may not be. And you need to bring a consensus. So they found a way to create a consensus around questions like that. No problem. Sounds good. The problem became when that sort of a method of questioning, getting the results, creating a new bank of questions in order to continually narrow the possible set of answers coming from the group, when that toolbox started to be used around state questions, town hall issues, corporate planning, and so on, then it became, because you can come up with new banks of questions as the results come in, it ends up being a tool that, frankly, planners, nefarious planners, can use to move that consensus to the point to where they want it. And then once they've done that, they can tell you, well, the people have spoken. You know, all of your peers believe that we should pass a bond election and build a new civic center, a new concert hall in Tulsa, for example, which is what happened. These, the Delphi method, had town hall meetings. They passed an enormous tax increase that was only going to last for a few years. It's still around. I don't know anybody that wanted it, but we were told that they had town hall meetings, and that was the community consensus, and then it passed.
We're seeing a similar version as far as like what the article is calling for, relying on the wisdom of consensus, right? Well, I mean, Wikipedia is Wikipedia was sold to us as like a community of people coming together, fact-checking each other, coming up with the best treatment of a topic or a person or an event or whatever, a philosophy. And from there, it's like, all right, well, once now we establish the consensus and people are kind of rooted down almost through this funnel to finding this thing that's like, hey, this isn't just this isn't sponsored content. This is the fucking consensus.
This is what people know.
Yeah, exactly. The author of this article, who's not obviously alone in this project, is kind of like showing you the way down to that information from this just overwhelming panorama at the top of the funnel, which is like you relying on your own critical thinking and information literacy skills at the panorama, which obviously, as we've learned here in the New York Times, is ill-advised. So yeah, it's the same. But the similarity is that, you know, watching some of these Delphi meetings where they come together to discuss a public policy issue, right? And at the very beginning, it's like, yeah, you know, we're here because we're real interested in your input. And then they have this feedback loop. So whether you're talking about the impaneling of experts or public policy, like a town hall meeting or something like that, once you have the established consensus already in mind, then you just have a feedback loop of at stage two, what do you have to get rid of? How does the window narrow in a way that's beneficial to the preset consensus, which we're seeing a version of in you know, the information world here for sure.
Yeah, this article can only appear once that consensus is already controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time that somebody in this article, they tell the user, if you encounter something odd, go check the consensus. Well, they wouldn't have done that until the consensus was controlled.
Right.
So now that the consensus is controlled, they can narrow that consensus, like you say, to the point that, well, it's like newspeak, and to the point that people they literally can't conceive ideas outside of that consensus. They will not have the intellectual toolbox to do that. Oh, God, it drives me crazy.
Right. And so, but you also see like a fairly long running pretext on things like what is the avatar? What is the caricature of an anti-vaxxer? Right. And how do we take that label and apply it to anybody who has a question about what's going on now? Right. So it kind of like a long lead into that. So all that being said, everything that we've just said, we come back to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and what we just read about, like, well, geez, should you just take an Instagram post from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. even fairly seriously when you have these great tools at your disposal that only take 15 seconds to discern the truth? And so it continues from there.
Can I read a little chunk from Infogalactic's page about Robert F. Kennedy?
Please do.
So, you know, this guy looks up Wikipedia and sees that he's an anti-vaccine activist and a conspiracy theorist. Here's a little of the bio from Infogalactic. Robert Francis Kennedy Jr., born in 1954, he is the son of RFK, the RFK. He's a Democrat. This is here in his bio. Education, London School of Economics, Harvard University, University of Virginia. He is an American radio host, environmental activist, author, and attorney specializing in environmental law. You go down here a little bit. Kennedy is an avid whitewater rafter, has a longstanding interest in environmental issues related to water resources, water pollution, and the Hudson River. So anyway, you read this, and you're not going to see conspiracy theorists on this page. And what you find out is you've got a Democrat here who's an attorney who is actually an environmentalist,
mm-hmm.
who's very concerned about water quality. Now, vaccines probably aren't necessarily in his wheelhouse. But as somebody who's interested in water quality and environmentalism, well, what you're finding here is somebody that is traditionally a Democrat and a Kennedy is somebody who's traditionally on the left who's coming out against the vaccine. Ooh, now that's a little more nuanced story about somebody being an anti-vaxxer. Wikipedia can't have it.
Right.
This guy is not Alex Jones.
But yeah. The label that he's given earlier on, anti-vaccine activist and a conspiracy theorist, it'd be hard to distinguish him from Alex Jones based on the labeling that took place. So from there, we move on to this. Is Robert F. Kennedy the best unbiased source on information about a vaccine? I'd argue no. And that's good enough to know. We should probably just move on, Caulfield said. He probed deeper into the method to find better coverage by copying the main claim in Mr. Kennedy's post and pasting it into a Google search. The first two results came from, I'm guessing this is like some French press agency's fact check website, and the National Institutes of Health. His quick searches showed a pattern. So this is where I was like, is this guy fucking with us? Right? The first two results show a pattern. Mr. Kennedy's claims were out. All right, now here we go. Mr. Kennedy's claims were outside the consensus. a sign they were motivated by something other than science.
Science. I remember being a kid and watching the television, the news TV show, 60 Minutes, when they did journalism. Mm-hmm. And I remember news stories, investigative news articles or stories that they did about Alar. If I remember correctly, it was an insecticide that was used on apples in the 50s and 60s that had horrific consequences to pregnant mothers that ate apples with Alar on them, and thalidomide. Do you know anything about these things? Am I talking?
Yeah, I've heard these stories.
Yeah. So the scientific consensus at the time was that Alar was good. Dimethizide was a plant growth regulator, a chemical sprayed on fruit to regulate their growth, make their harvest easier, and keep apples from falling off the tree before they ripen. It was first approved for use in 1963 and primarily used on apples until 89 because it was making people sick. But for years, the consensus was that that was okay. Same thing with DDT, thalidomide. You know, over and over again, the scientific consensus is proven to be wrong. And thank God you have people who dissent from that consensus and show us that thalidomide is causing enormous problems with birth defects and harming people. Mm-hmm. Thank God somebody pointed out that DDT maybe ain't so good. You know, you need these people outside the consensus because you can't trust it. Science is never right about anything. That's a big claim, but it's not. Induction, the scientific method, can't actually prove a truth claim. I can pick up a ball and drop it 10,000 times, and then you can have a little clicker, and every time I drop it, you can click that clicker and count, oh gosh, you know, we've dropped it 10,000 times. And then we can do a paper and write a paper about it and assert that because we dropped a ball 10,000 times, every single time a ball will be dropped, it will fall. And then we can have it peer-reviewed and published in Science magazine. Mm-hmm. We didn't actually prove that the ball will always fall. We have every reason to believe that it will always fall. But because we're using induction, we can't actually prove it. You can't actually prove it. Mm-hmm. It's not a deadlock certainty like deduction is, where you have a syllogism. You can't do that. We can't go from the specific to the general there. Now, go from that. You know, the ball example in gravity seems a little weird, but we can't listen, guys. I know that they didn't tell you this in your science class in seventh grade. We can't even prove that balls always fall. We can't. We have every reason to believe that's so. And then we start trying to prove even more complex problems and more complex concepts that have far more variables in them, and they have even more unknown variables in them than something like dropping a damn ball. So we use consensus, where we have a bunch of people try to guess if the ball is going to fall based on what we've seen. Then the ball doesn't matter anymore. The only thing that matters is the consensus. And it doesn't work. You end up giving moms thalidomide and their kids come out with lobster claw hands. Mm-hmm. That's what they call the syndrome. It's terrible. But here he goes. A powerful person like Kennedy, who's an environmental attorney, is probably somebody that you want to actually be barking about vaccines.
Yeah, and so he obviously has a legacy of doing this that precedes the current controversy. But, you know, he runs together with the effectiveness of two labels, like conspiracy theorists. That's been employed since the 1960s, invented by the CIA to deal with people who had questions about the Warren Commission report. Anti-vaxxer, I'd say there's been a pretty effective campaign slapping that label very broadly against anybody, like creating this caricature of anybody who has a question about anything is now in this pool where you can't, from labels used here, you can't distinguish an environmental lawyer, son of Robert F. Kennedy, from Alex Jones or the like. You can't make that distinction, nor do you need to, according to what we're reading right here. So, and what you're talking about, the ball dropping example, is so steel trapped, such an open and shut case compared to the stuff that we're talking about now, but it's not being treated any differently.
I've given that example in seminars and online grade books and other podcasts, and I've used that example for 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a group of people that think I'm absolutely crazy for saying that you can't prove the ball's going to fall.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
They think I'm nuts. Now, I have every reason to believe that it is going to fall. The probability that it's going to fall is like enormously huge.
Yeah.
But it's not a deadlock. That's all I'm telling you. Guys, we thought... Everybody thought that Ptolemy was right until Newton came up. And everybody thought Newton was right until Einstein came up. Like, the science is always wrong. And if it's not wrong entirely, it's incomplete. And it always is, and it can't be other, because it's not deduction, it's induction. And that's when I'm being generous, because social sciences aren't even that.
Yeah, and this whole current controversy is basically being moderated by a man who a month ago can go on television on a friendly media and say, I am the science. And then when pressed a few days ago, can say, well, we've always said that science is an ever-evolving process. So you have both platitudes at your disposal, and there's lots of things that come into that, like narrative control, which is what we're talking about right here, and just as far as even like what science means and the surrounding, like we're not even just dealing with science anymore, right? There's political implications, there's financial implications, there's all kinds of psychological, mass psychological implications in this now. So this is really, really muddy. But we just finished the part where it's like his quick searches showed a pattern. Mr. Kennedy's claims were outside the consensus, a sign they were motivated by something other than science. The SIFT method and the instructional teaching unit, and then parenthetically, it says about 6 hours of classwork. So just take our word for it here, Dipstick, that accompanies it has been picked up by dozens of universities across the country and some Canadian high schools. What is potentially revolutionary about SIFT is that it focuses on making quick judgments. A SIFT fact check can and should take just 30, 60, 90 seconds to evaluate a piece of content.
Yeah.
I mean, we just saw it done with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So, like, I don't know, maybe I have a digital literacy deficiency that I need to work on here, but I think what I basically just read was, don't investigate, go to Google, you've got 15 seconds of work ahead of you, and you can get the truth.
Yeah, it's again, everything's an inversion. It's the opposite of the truth.
Right.
No, the more important an idea is, the more time you should spend on it. Yeah, so when we read Aristotle's Metaphysics and Online Great Books, we take 2 months, and you ought to take years for it. Mm-hmm. If it's important, you need to spend a lot of time on it. It's just crazy. Everybody knows that. Like, let's say there's a bond election in your town and you're going to vote because you're supposed to vote. And we're told that that's what good people do. And you need to know the issues. How much time are you going to spend on that? Like, if it's an issue that's near and dear to you and means something, how much time are you going to spend on that?
90 seconds, the max, according to this.
The next paragraph, I'll read it.
Yeah, please do. This is an interesting one. I actually wanted your thoughts on the first sentence.
The four steps are based on the premise that you often make a better decision with less information than you do with more. Also, spending 15 minutes to determine a single fact in order to decipher a tweet or a piece of news coming from a source you've never seen before will often leave you more confused than you were before. The question we want students asking is this a good source for this purpose, or could I find something better relatively quickly, Mr. Caulfield said. I've seen the classroom where a student finds a great answer in 3 minutes, but then keeps going and ends up won over by bad information.
There goes Gatto's encouragement to argue with yourself. You know, right? That's immediately out the window in a crisis. The Whitman's multitudes, where you'll accept the discomfort of wrestling with contradictions in your own head. That's not crisis thinking. It is perpetual, 100% crisis thinking all the time, and here's how to do it.
You often make a better decision with less information than you do with more. I had a lot of friends who were engineers, and those guys can definitely suffer from the old analysis paralysis.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that, like, you could generate, like, if you wanted to argue that point, if he was the third person on our call right now and we wanted to argue that point, he could give us 50 examples of places where that's true.
Right.
But obviously some complex research topic is not one of them.
Right. And even the folks that are in analysis paralysis, the exhortation shouldn't be to do it with less information and more. It should be about, hey, you need to do a better job of determining what is the most important information. What is the most important information? What is the most likely information? What is the information that's most likely to affect my outcome?
Right.
That's the thing they need to be taught to do. Instead of considering the source and trying to figure out what the consensus is about the information, what information is most pertinent here? And now, that can get rid of the analysis paralysis.
So, I mean, like, just in my own life, there's lots of, like, cool, useful, efficient, like, audio and video editing hacks. Mm. Some I figured out on my own, and they were time-consuming. And some I went into YouTube and said, how do I do this thing? Because the consequences of me doing that thing wrong or trusting the wrong person on YouTube were basically nil, right? Like, oh, that didn't work. I have to try something else. And there were times where the problem or the goal was unique enough where I had to use kind of a trivium method, right? I had to learn all the component parts of what I was doing and understand how they work together and then put that to use for me. It was this kind of broad investigative approach at the beginning where there was grammar to learn. And if you don't know what this thing is or you don't understand why it works, and like what if the person says, oh, you just go 1, 2, 3 in their 3-minute video and I don't get the exact result I want. Well, they knew what to do, but I didn't. So now I need to figure out what they know so I can modify it to get the results that I want. That's certainly something that you've had to do. Those are all like very, very low stakes endeavors compared to what this article. I mean, we see the direction that it went. How are we going to deal with people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. polluting your information world? What do we do about that? Right? Because we've got a busy 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 months ahead of us here. So you can't be getting slowed down by people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when it comes to your decision making.
Right.
Right. The stakes are much higher in what's being talked about here. But I could say, yeah, Caulfield, you're right. I've got 50 examples of times where YouTube videos solve my problem. How do I take my engine air filter off? 4-minute project. Right. I don't need to diagram my whole engine.
The video is wrong about how to get the air filter off. You don't get it off. And you watch a different video and it's right. And the air filter comes off.
Bad example. I should, you know, like that's again, back to why we drive. I should have diagrammed my whole engine. First time I had a car when I was 16 years old, I should have opened the hood. I should have taken it apart, put it all back together. But for the time that I had, once the problem, considering the mistakes I made in that thing where I had to take the air filter off to do this other thing. Yes, you have to consider how much time you have to deal with this problem. But if the inundation, which the author of this article in this entire publication are participating in, of crisis, new thing you need to know, not just fear of missing out, death from missing out on, what the news is telling you today, the mind can't work that way anymore.
Yeah, I think your air filter example is a good one. What if... So, you know, we just go check out the YouTube video, and if it's not a good one, we'll watch another one. We'll get the darn filter changed. It's fine. And if it takes us 2 hitches, it's fine. What if it's shoot an experimental drug in your arm such that you don't get the Wu flu? And there are a large number of people that are saying, hey, we've never done this before. We don't know what exactly is going on. And once you've done it, you can't go back. There's no undoing it. Well, Caulfield, well, he says, you often make a better decision with less information. Well, as the stakes go up, the more information we need.
Mm-hmm.
Period. But he's telling you the opposite. I mean, how could that possibly be true? How could that possibly be true that we would need less information to make good decisions?
He's built a lot of momentum towards that idea, right? It's messy out there. There are savvy attention hijackers out there, right? That's why I use the pandemic analogy. Because it's like you're powerless against this thing. You think taking vitamin D and not being obese is going to help you against this thing that you could never fucking understand?
Right.
What we're dealing with there out there is like people on Stormfront, they've all been enrolled in some advanced mind manipulation course before they blog about being racist, right? About white supremacy. So you don't stand a chance against people like that. And the truth is they're all people like that. Geez, you know, I'm doing a show tonight with my friend Daryl Becker and Tony Myers, and we're kind of continuing that This Is a Test series that Daryl and I did last year. And I'm looking at this goddamn thing that just came out. Let me pull it up real quick. The Dirty Dozen of Disinformation.
Oh, I haven't heard of this.
Okay, so
I want to be on that.
This kind of ties into the Biden thing, where the Biden's to Facebook is killing people, and it's like some alarming percentage of Facebook misinformation. And as we know, misinformation results in death. That's another line that they're pushing, is like 70% of all Facebook misinformation around vaccines that's contributing to vaccine hesitancy is the work of 12 people. There is a kind of policy paper on this that I'm pulling up. It is from, wait till you hear this, the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Because you see, the savvy attention hijackers on this vaccine issue are people who are hijacking the attention. They're taking advantage of the attention of minorities who are suspicious about maybe governments injecting them with things.
Huh. I've heard of the Tuskegee experiments.
The subtext is, you know, they're trying to cash in on the paranoia of the uneducated, right?
Right.
I mean, these people can't even figure out how to get IDs, and you're going to interfere with us telling them what to do about vaccines? How dare you?
Right.
So then they start listing the people. They make this tie-in. I mean, and if I was an evil person trying to take control of the entire world, this is what a wonderful approach, right? Tie skepticism to racism. It's brilliant. I mean, especially after what we just went through in the last year and to a lesser degree in the last 5 or 6 years. So, you know, they've got their list. The first one is Joseph Mercola, a successful anti-vaccine entrepreneur. No mention that he is a doctor. That is number one on their list.
Right.
Conspiracy theorist and anti-vaccine, right? Is that the label RFK got? Yeah, that's what this guy is. Look no further, right? Also racist.
And by the way, this information doesn't policy paper or white paper or think piece by the Center for Countering Digital Hate is right out of the manufacturing consent playbook. It's right out of Walter Lippmann. It's right out of what Chomsky's telling us they're doing. So you form a think tank, you launder money through them, you pay them to, you know, come up with these pieces, and then your media then cites these pieces, and then that's how they manufacture the consent.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, who gives a fuck what the Center for Countering Digital Hate says? Like, what is digital hate? Who is this center? Like, what is this? I mean, this thing is, what is this even?
They're a center. Don't you know about centers?
Oh, right here at the beginning, it says the Center for Countering Digital Hate is a not-for-profit NGO that seeks to disrupt the architecture of online hate and misinformation. What? I know what all those words mean. When they put them together, I'm not sure. Digital technology has changed forever the way we communicate, build relationships, share knowledge, set social standards, and negotiate and assert our society's values. Digital spaces have been colonized and their unique dynamics exploited by fringe movements that instrumentalize hate and misinformation. These movements are opportunistic, agile, and confident in exerting influence and persuading people. The center's work combines both analysis and active disruption of these networks. CCDH's solutions seek to increase the economic, political, and social costs of all parts of the infrastructure, the actor systems and culture that support and often profit from hate and misinformation.
Right.
How in the fuck is Robert Kennedy profiting from this?
Now, there is a grain of truth in this. Like, maybe we knew a media personality or two who did okay, maybe trying to elevate their voice in, say, the libertarian world.
Oh,
and then they found that their voice and their rhetoric went a lot further once they kind of started dabbling in. I don't even want to say hate is just a dismissive label, so I don't want to use it. But they found some other world that's more associated with the people that the center criticizes, and they did better. Right there. I mean, there is a huge market. But see, this is the thing that will also never be looked at. Like, why is there this explosion in the market for alternative information that's being flooded by people who didn't get much as far as critical thinking skills or information literacy skills in their 15,000 hours of government school? It's kind of like the thing that, you know, people always say about the DARE program. It's like, you know, DARE said marijuana was going to kill me and it didn't. So I was like, what else are they lying about? And then I did all these other drugs. I was lied to in college, and then I took this whole bottle of red pills, as Michael Malice says, right? Yeah, I think there is a tiny bit of fire that has generated this entire smokescreen that is being put up here, but a small problem has been weaponized into a very big, dangerous, finger quote, solution, and this policy paper is kind of an example of that. Right. So it's like we've got a paper from a center. Right. And the center says that it's 12 people doing 70% of the damage. So let's use that as the pretext for social media platforms taking marching orders. Not like this is a new thing either. It's just I think it's never been this front and center in the public mind before. Responsible social media platforms just trying to help. I mean, Zuckerberg will tell you that we're just trying to help. Just trying to get the right information out there, will now take marching orders from the government on what can and can be on social media platforms. And these 12 people who are killing minorities with misinformation will set the precedent for what we're going to do to all of you.
Oh, my gosh. I'm looking here at this paper. Joseph Mercola. Now, they just say Joseph. He's an MD.
Yeah, they say they call him a successful anti-vaccine entrepreneur.
Yeah. Peddling dietary supplements and false cures as alternatives to vaccines. He's a physician. Now, I'm not going to make some sort of appeal to authority because most physicians are I'm not impressed, but they're just, they're burying that. And then it has example violations. These are social media posts that he's made that are example violations. They call them violations of what? I'm not sure. Here's a graphic. It says scam. The same number of people have died in 2020 that on average have died in previous years. This simply wouldn't be the case if we had a lethal pandemic. Now, wait a minute. Is that not true? Is there veracity in that?
Mm-hmm.
There were very, very few deaths attributed to influenza last year. Approximately, you know, within statistical noise, the same number of people died in the United States in 2020 as die in the average year. Everywhere I've looked, that claim it has held up. But he is not allowed to say that.
Unless those numbers have been doctored, because Daryl and I, we really got hung up on this in a long time where for it didn't look like global or even U.S. deaths had increased from 2019 to 2020. And I've seen new information. Daryl actually had a guy compile a bunch of statistics for him, and it does look like there was an increase. Now, that might mean that legitimately there was an increase. I'm sure there were lots of stress-related deaths. I'm sure there were a lot more suicides because I don't think there was any attribution on what we looked at as far as cause, right? You're just either talking like U.S. total deaths or global deaths, meaning that even without a specific breakdown, you should be able to see a significant increase considering the government reaction that followed the emergence of SARS-CoV-2. But he does have an image here that says scam, and he does make this claim. And there's lots of ways like to deal with the scam part or to deal with the claim part where, I mean, you can produce data that show anything, right? So somebody from a center could come back and say, we're the center from such and fuck, and we have this different data that proves this wrong. And people all the way up into like medical research can pick the data they want to do the thing they already decided to do. So this isn't like a real tough road to hoe here with saying this is misinformation. Now, they've made their work easier at the Center for Whatever, Countering Digital Hate, by choosing to pick Instagram posts where you have the size of a fucking cell phone screen to make your case. Right. So you see this again and again. What do they call it? Example violations. Right. I mean, it's easy. These are memes. And that's an easy thing. Well, this is leaving a lot out of the picture. Yeah, it's a fucking meme. It's leaving a lot out of the picture. But it seems to be what they choose is these people's Instagram posts. I've scrolled through the first three and I've seen either Facebook posts or Instagram posts as their example violations.
And to be fair, that's how people reach other people.
And that's what people read and form opinions from now, too.
I have a blog at scotthamprick.com. And I write long-form things there and rant and whatever, and people think it's humorous. But nobody reads it in comparison to my social media stuff. You know, if I put something on Instagram, that it's going to be, you know, orders of magnitude more people read that there.
Mm-hmm. You
know, so that's what they have to quote because that's the only thing anybody looks at. But so what if he uses rhetoric? This whole article is written by people for people who I don't understand and are lost to me.
Yeah.
You know, I just said it a while ago. Who cares if he uses this kind of rhetoric or that kind of rhetoric? I would leave it up to the individual to determine if his rhetoric about a scam and these deaths or whatever is true or false. Well, these people that wrote this and these people that read this and take it at heart cared very, very deeply about that. And we're not going to convince each other of the other stance. I'm not going to convince Mr. Caulfield that people can go read and discern for themselves. I'm not going to convince him, and he's not going to convince me that I should make snap judgments about facts, about assertions I see on the internet. We're not going to convince each other. I mean, this is just more evidence of the divide between these sort of camps in the U.S. that I despair of.
Mm.
Yeah. So more and more that I see points out to me how different the minds of these two camps. I mean, I'm making it simple, right? There's more than two groups, but anything like this I read just points out to me more and more starkly how differently the minds of these groups of people work and how their differences are not reconcilable.
Right. Let me ask you this, and I think this is like a practical question for the people who've listened to us this far into the conversation. One of the things that I've been saying is like counter-narrative, give up, right? But there still are lots of ways to, I would like to believe there still are ways to raise curiosity, right? To get people, like, people should now have more questions than ever. And I'm seeing a lot of people who don't. And sure, that's a bit frightening to me.
Yeah.
But the possibility still exists. And then again, it's like, yeah, we don't have to focus on the 50, 60, whatever percent of people who are completely lost and never coming back. And who, at every time a trial balloon goes up, they grab onto it and say, we. That's not our audience and not something that I think we need to focus on. But there's lots of very quiet people on the margin going, what the fuck is going on? Right. Now, they might be of an age where, you know, they really at this point don't serve the future very well, you know, if they've got a couple of years left to be skeptical from retirement. But I do think that even if you acknowledge a loss in the political war, in the culture war, the medical war, and all of those things obviously are very intertwined at this point, there still are a lot of people out there who are waiting to be competent thinkers, who are waiting to exercise some curiosity, and who, you know, I know this from experience, from people who are close to me, somebody saying, yeah, you know, I always associated more with the left and lived in a very left-wing environment. And when I started having questions, I didn't feel like there was any place to ask them, and I didn't feel like they would be received like they were appropriate, like it was okay to have those questions, which is something that I'm sure people said in Salem, Massachusetts in the 1690s. Right.
Right.
So I want to continue to, and I hope other people continue, at least cast life rafts for people who want them, and at least do the things that will inspire some curiosity and some skepticism without counter narrative. Right. Because as soon as you have like a counter narrative, it comes with an agenda, and the person that you're trying to reach out to has a defensive posture. Right. Because it's like now there's a threat. There's an incursion into some kind of worldview that, even though it's incredibly stressful and dismaying and paranoia inducing and hate filled, gives me some kind of comfort. Right. I'm getting some kind of, and we've seen plenty of like people that we've interacted with in the libertarian world. That's a common problem, what I just described. And I started telling libertarians 4 or 5 years ago, you better fucking look at these people because they're a mirror. It might be a funhouse mirror, but it's a mirror. Right. If you're concerned about public perception or actually reaching out to people and not just being, you know, an asshole, like, you need to look at what these people are doing and not act like them.
Or do you act exactly like them and move the ball down the field? Like, they're winning. Back to what I said earlier, they're winning.
Mm-hmm. Winning what, though? Well, I mean, in the end, what do they win?
All the power and all the control. Now, their view of the good and what to do with that power isn't good. And so I think that there will be bad consequences of that. But, you know, we don't have any newspapers. We don't have any schools. The cultural game is theirs to do with what they will at this point. We look at them and say, oh, they don't play fair. Oh, they're, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I'm kind of done with that. Like, when they go low, we go high kind of thing. Like, that's not interesting to me. But if the contest is over and now it's kind of like, let's operate in our sphere of control where we have maybe people in our lives. Like, I've gotten phone calls from people from my far distant past saying, I'm in this situation that's going to affect my life and my livelihood. What do you think I should do? I'm also getting like a lot of these stories, like in the university meetings where people feel like their families, their social, in-person social connections have been sabotaged. I've heard about this, like breaking into people's churches, basically. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine ran a church group that became very strained because I think this was even before the vaccine was on the table. This was over the masks. You know, this was last year. Mm-hmm. People still, as far as like sphere of control is concerned, and inside what's inside your sphere of control, need means of outreach. I still think that has to be like part of that's kind of a survival thing at this point, I think, in a lot of ways. It's your job, it's your family, it's your social network, it's the people that you rely on, and more of them becoming possessed by this, or increasingly possessed by this. And I just don't know if you have any thoughts you'd want to share about. I mean, you talk to a lot of people. You talk to a lot of frustrated people. What practical actions can be taken?
I don't know. I'm just trying to create an echo chamber, man. That's what I'm accused of. I just try to conserve my energy. I don't want to engage with people who are using the SIFT method here.
Right.
You know, yeah. I had some people try to argue with me last night on Instagram about some things. I just blocked them. You know, I'm not going to convince them. I recognize that very quickly nowadays. You know, this is not somebody that I'm going to change whose mind I'm going to change or come bring them around to my way of thinking. And I just block them. I don't owe them anything. Mm. You know, I'm not an evangelist in that way. You know, if somebody responds to something I say by saying, "So what you're saying is," which is always followed with bullshit.
Yeah.
You're blocked. So what you're, I said what I fucking said. Don't make up something by saying, "So what you're saying is." Anything that follows "So what you're saying is a straw man. So you're blocked. You're gone. I'm not going to mess with that. Now, if somebody says, "Can you clarify this for me? You said, does that apply in this way?" You know, if they have a thoughtful question like that, man, I'm in. We're friends. Let's go.
Okay. Yeah. That's a thoughtful question. Yeah. Somebody said to me, I posted something about CRT and somebody's like, "Can you provide examples?" And I said, "Can I provide examples? My rate for providing examples to strangers online is $100 an hour."
Right. That's another thing that'll get you blocked. If they're like sources ? You're blocked. Like,
cause that's not a good faith ask, right? Can you provide examples? Like, you can provide, read this New York Times article. It takes you 30 seconds to find examples.
Right.
You know? So, you know, blocking people that you're just not going to have, there's people who don't have that option though. It's right, like, I want to go see my family and I'm told I can't. I've heard that story 5 times now. From the small number of people that I directly interact with, I can't go see my family anymore,
right,
unless I do this thing. And to me, that's a problem to solve.
They're going to have to figure out what this thing means to them.
Yeah.
You know, if the family says, you can't come to Thanksgiving unless you've had the Fauci-ouchie.
Yeah.
You're going to have to weigh it out, you know, and maybe seeing grandma and so on is more important. And you go get the shot, or maybe your misgivings about the shot are greater and more important to you than going. They have told you what the rules are. You just got to figure it out. And there's nothing that I could say, or you could say, or anybody could say that would make that easier for them. If your family has thrown the gauntlet down in that way, it's just on you.
Yeah.
You know, and if you decide you're not going to get the vaccination, so you don't get to go to Thanksgiving with your family anymore again, then that's the decision you made. And don't even be mad about it. That's the world you live in now. That's the way it is, man.
Right.
That's the way it is. If your employer sends you a memo and says, "We've scheduled your vaccination for Friday at 10 a.m. and your employment's contingent on it," you're going to have to figure out what's more important to you. Life's not going to make this easy for you. You've got to figure it out. And there are going to be consequences. And in 10 years, when people are getting all these heart transplants and stuff because of the chronic inflammation from this thing, then you'll know. You know, grandma will be dead already. And, you know, then you'll know if your calculus paid off. I can't make making those decisions easier. It's unfortunate that people's families and employers and the society is putting people in a position. They're backing people into a corner and putting them in a position to make these hard decisions.
Yeah,
that's unfortunate. But that's where we're at. That's what it is, man. That's who we are.
I think that that's an important thing for me to hear. This is a question that I'm going to continue to put to people that I converse with on this show. Those guys tonight, Tony and Daryl, very smart, thoughtful guys who certainly have navigated that a lot in the past with people in their lives, you know, with family, friends, colleagues. But this is a very realistic starting point. I mean, what you're saying is true. And as more and more examples come in, it's like, yeah, this is a problem. There is this question of like, how can this be solved? What can be done about this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then it is like, all right, well, what is the extent of my sphere of control here? Maybe I'm feeling optimistic. Maybe I built some credibility through like doing what I've done for so long that other people don't have. But gosh, you know, I wish there was a way that I could help those people. I mean, I really like, I feel for them, you know, and these are private conversations or our small group conversations, but I hear these stories and they suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody that I know and who's a good faith discussion partner says, "Hey, you know, Thanksgiving's coming in November," on the group family text message thread, Uncle Harry says that if you don't have your vaccine passport, you can't come to Thanksgiving dinner. What do I do? Hey, we'll talk about it. But ultimately, you know, and I'll help be a support group, whether you'll see Uncle Harry or not. But ultimately, you have to decide.
All right. This is a big ethical question, and I'm going to have to wrap up at 11:30, but or my time. So we're like 10:30 your time. So maybe we'll cliffhang it. Maybe you can come talk about it a little bit Sunday. But like, let's say you're given this choice of do this thing, right? Submit in a way that is going to compromise your sense of self, maybe for your entire life. Submit to see your family in a way that, whether you want to face it or not, is going to build all kinds of resentment against whoever gave you that ultimatum. Or realize the madness that surrounds you and lie. So there is more to this conversation, but given the nature of what we talked about next, I didn't want to put it here for just anybody to find. So if you support us through any of our support channels, that would be schoolsucksproject.locals.com, patreon.com/schoolsucks, or through the AV Club, you can get access to this recording. If you're in the university but not in any of these other places, I'll drop the link for the audio in the Discord. For those of you who support us on Patreon or the AV Club, there are links to continue listening to the remainder of the show right in the show notes for this episode. And my final request of this show, this week, this July, there is a very thoughtful and dedicated team of people working on the creation of a School Sucks yearbook, and they are currently making their final push for submission. So if you have a personal message that you would like to send to me, I wasn't even supposed to know about this, but to get them, you know, as many submissions as we could, we had to use some of my channels, which include, you know, the podcast, the email list. So I found out about it that way, and I'm very, very honored that this is something that a group of people are working on. I will be thanking all the members of the, I don't want to call it a committee, the group, the team. I will be thanking all members of the team on a future episode by name. But I'm very grateful, and I'd love to hear a few words from you if you've been listening for a while. So there is a link to a Google Doc in the show notes, and there's a little form you can fill out there. But it's got to be done by this weekend at the latest. Okay, thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next week.
Look out, the candy man. Here he comes and he's gone.